welcome everybody to the Brownback Lecture Series. And as I've mentioned, I'm not going to be talking about Talk to Me. That Brownback Lecture will take place next week. But I am Larissa Bailiff, and I'm going to talk to you today about Louis Fuller and dance performance and innovation around the turn of the century. I'm going to let people come in. Can we get the lights down just a little bit further? Thank you so much. Okay. And I've already gotten some questions from people who came in earlier. Again, we're going to be touching on the visual arts. I make a confession at the very beginning that I'm not a dance historian, and I come to this as an art historian who is very interested in the fin de siècle, visual imagery, material culture, and fell in love with Louis Fuller, and I think you will too as well. Okay. So the title of my talk today is Tripping the Light Fantastic, Louis Fuller and the Convergence of Dance and Art, and there we see her. You know, frozen in time, certainly not the experience that we would have had of her. And I also wanted to just say as we start that I dedicate this talk today to my friend Alan Kanzer, who also has a love of the 19th century and wasn't able to make it today. So I'm going to have Janelle turn on a YouTube clip and have us get an experience of a Louis Fuller dance. And I'm going to have the lights maybe dim just even lower and want you to imagine that you are in the Folies Bergères à Paris in a sort of horseshoe-shaped set of seats experiencing this. And we'll try to get as close to it, so to speak, as we can.
Their music to her dancing?
Yes, as far as I understand. So it would have been a you know, different experience than this. Also to say this is a film which is hand-tinted. So we'll talk about the technology of the colors of the costume and some of the lighting effects. But you know, this is a film in some ways recreation because the color has been tinted onto the film itself to try to recreate the experience that we would have had as an audience.
Yeah, this is faster than she would have done it. It looks to me that way. Yeah.
Absolutely. But at least it can give us a sense of, and of course, we sort of move between that and, you know, film stills, which doesn't, you know, give us quite the experience we would be having either way.
The multiple colors, were they shining different colored lights on the
white? Yes, they were. They were, and I love all these questions. What I am going to say is I want us to try to hold them till the end, if we can, because I think other people are thinking them as well, and I will try to cover most of these things. But if I don't, you know, keep them in mind and you know, ask me, and we'll try to get to them. So, but we will talk about her technologies, and yes, they were, she was a sort of, well, incredibly innovative in terms of her use of lighting technicians and collaborating with them to create these magical effects. She herself called herself a sculptor of light, and others called her magician of light because she really used light in innovative and amazing ways. So our talk today, including questions at the end, will be approximately 45 minutes. And I stress that because, in fact, many of her performances were about 45 minutes long. That's how long she would perform in an evening. Sometimes, you know, performing again and again or going to a, you know, dance for a private group. But I want us to think about the endurance to be able to perform for that length of time, even with short breaks, for instance. It's quite a feat. But I also want us to think about that in terms of this framework of our conversation today. I've sort of envisioned my discussion of Louis Fuller's performance and her innovation and history almost like a performance in and of itself. That doesn't mean I'm going to dance for you. You're very lucky I'm not going to dance for you. But with a sort of little prologue and maybe three acts in between, discussion of her innovation and technology would be the first act. Discussion of artist representations and engagement with Louis Fuller, and then, you know, and thinking about promotion, her promotion of self, but also how she promoted other artists as a third act, and then finally sort of the last years of her life and what she's involved in. So there's a lot of material to cover, but I think it's a way to package Louis into you know, our brief foray today. So here is a fairly early photograph here. And I use it to suggest in some ways how far she comes, or at least her early years, this being our little prologue here. And we see her in, you know, in stage costume, probably a publicity shot. And I want to mention that she was born in Chicago. So Louis Fuller is an American. And as she liked to say, born in America, made in Paris. And we'll think about what that means. And she makes herself in Paris, really. And that's one of the most exciting things about her. She's born in 1862. She dies in 1928. Although she, like many performers, shaved off many years as she got older and older. What performer doesn't do this? In fact, your speaker today is the tender age of 21. Ha-ha. So, anyway, back to Louis Fuller. As I said, she's born in Chicago, or just outside in Fullersburg, and just to sum up her early career, well, in fact, it begins as a child. Apparently, at the very young age, you know, 3, 4, or 5, she stands up in church and starts singing Mary Had a Little Lamb, and it was all over from there. Her mother knew that, you know, this was a woman, or a child at that point, destined for the stage. She got applause. She liked it. She would go on to give temperance lectures and become involved in vaudeville. She was never trained classically. And we might consider, in thinking about her, whether she's a performer or a dancer. I truly believe she's a dancer, but it's certainly stretching some of the boundaries of dance. Because we're going to be thinking about her movements and the modern push that she gives in visual terms. So she's creating images on the stage. She's also creating science. She's creating magic. But it very much ties in with the artistic language of the moment. And I think that's why she captivated people so much and became the toast of Paris. By 1900, Paris was really Louis Fuller's. She was friends with literary circles and the toast of the town. But for now, and I think this is actually taken after she lands in Paris, but we're going to pretend this is an earlier image and think about her days as a vaudeville actress, sometimes dancing, but mostly acting, and jump to a sort of transformative point. She is performing in the early 1890s in a production called Quack MD. So it's about a doctor, about a hypnotist, and she's got a bit part, and, you know, she's struggling. She's, what, 28, 29, and, you know, trying to make ends meet, and apparently, you know, she's in the middle of the performance, and the psychiatrist figure is hypnotizing her, and Loire's drapery is a bit long, and she decides that she's really going to get into it, and she pretends to be hypnotized, and raises her arms and sort of floats across the stage. And apparently the audience just reveled in this moment and started clapping and, you know, saw this figure floating and this drapery and her movement and felt that she embodied this state, not only of, you know, someone who was hypnotized, but a butterfly, an orchid. And they were exclaiming. And so Laura just, you know, continued and, you know, it became this hit. Well, the play wasn't a hit. In fact, Quack MD closed shortly thereafter, but people were starting to take a little bit of notice. And Louis turned this into a dance, and or at least worked with it. And I want to suggest that, you know, she was very intent on her choreography, her movements, looking in the mirror, seeing how light streamed through her clothing, using more and more drapery. You know, whether we go to anecdotes, and she gives us many in her memoirs, you know, how much was accident, you know, it's hard to say, but she quickly picked up on things and realized that this was going to be a mode for her that she could utilize, that she could expand on. And so she created an art out of it, going, traveling around America a little bit, going to London, and then winding up in Paris. One of the interesting things, by the time she ended up in Paris in 1892, is that there were already people impersonating her dances. So she shows up at the Folies Bergères, and there's already somebody doing her serpentine dance. Now, Louis actually tried to patent her dance in America, or several of her dances, and they turned her down. So this is part of dance history. And why did they turn her down? Well, it wasn't that they didn't like her dance, it's just that they didn't recognize it as something that could be patented. And they said to her, and you know, thinking about the video that we just watched, there's no narrative, there's no story, right? You're embodying something, a snake or movement or a sign or an orchid or a butterfly, but if there's no story to it, you can't patent it. That didn't stop her from patenting other aspects of her dance. And here we see her, right? And that's, you know, closer to the video and the expression, her mode of using long flowing drapery. And, you know, I want us to again, think about the transformation from vaudeville dancer actress to this, you know, within a few short years. So in 1892, as I said, she shows up in Paris in October. By November, she is working at the Folies Bergères. And in fact, she ousted the impersonator. She went to the manager and she said, well, I don't know, this person who's doing my serpentine dance, that's mine, but I'll perform it for you. And when he saw her do the dance, he realized that's the artist, that is the creator. She does something really that nobody else can do. Before we leave these first two slides, I just want to sort of mention as well, and maybe you're getting a sense of this, I already said that Louis was, you know, on the cusp of 30. She'd already had a life. She'd already been married for a while to a trigamist. That didn't work out. But, you know, in terms of her physique, you know, she is not necessarily what we might consider a typical dancer, lithe, you know, slim, petite. She's more stocky and wholesome, shall we say. And this is also very interesting in terms of her transformation on stage, that she becomes something completely other, and this is something that people spoke quite a bit about. So even from this slide here, with a wonderful movement and gesture to this, and this symbolizes her, you know, time at the Folies Bergères, and also the way in which she was embraced right away by poster makers of the day, celebrated. She commissioned some of them. Others, you know, created artworks to celebrate her without commissions. And we see Jules Charest here, who was the foremost poster maker in Paris at this time. Everybody wanted to be portrayed by Charest, and he was a great publicist. But if we see what he's emphasized, you know, treat this as material culture, he's not really giving us a portrait of Louis Fuller, who became known as La Louis, it's hard for me to say. But what he is stressing about her is not just the folds of drapery and the lighting effects that we'll begin to talk about, but a sort of idealized beauty, the sort of titillation of the, you know, kicked up leg and, you know, cleavage sort of thrown out and revealed. If one looks at Charest's posters from the time, and this is one in MoMA's collection, although we have many, he tends to emphasize this sort of feminine, idealized, non-specific cheesecake sort of quality. Now, I turn right now to a different image, and it's to give us just even the basics of how things were a little bit different, how Louis innovated things. Here we have a photograph of La Goulue, the glutton. All of these dancers had nicknames, and you know, it's not a very nice nickname, but she was at the height of her career. Her real name was Louise Weber. And by the way, same first name as Marie Louise Fuller, which is Lalois's real name. So here is Louise Weber, who is showing us a very high kick for which she was known. She also performed at the Folies Bergères and the Moulin Rouge and other places. And as I said, she was at the height of her career, and she gives us a sense of quadrilles and can-cans and sort of high-kicking dances that were what people expected to see when they went to these nightclubs. So we see her, as I said, in the photograph. We see her here also in this poster, a poster which made Toulouse-Lautrec's name, and it also made La Goulue's. We see her there with her telltale top knot, very signature style of hair, as she wore it then, showing us her little pantaloons there, and the man in front in silhouette was a dance partner of hers, Valentin Le Désossé, or the Snake Man. So again, everybody has these nicknames, they have their shtick, and they perform to rowdy, raucous crowds. And again, it's a great poster of Toulouse-Lautrec. We have it in our collection, and you know, we could spend more time with this if our subject wasn't Louise Fuller. But I do want to suggest the shorter skirts and the notion of using skirts, you know, for movement, but in this instance, much more provocatively, you know, in sort of sexualized ways for greater titillation. And as La Goulue often did, and some of the other dancers, she was often known for, well, lifting up her skirts from behind. So we're talking about, you know, very provocative, very revealing, a bit louche, these activities. We'll see her represented one more time. Louis never had, never commissioned Toulouse-Lautrec, although we'll see some wonderful works by him. And here we see the idea of magazines beginning to pick up on this interest in not only dance culture, but particularly in La Loi and Louis. And we see her throughout these images. I know they're very small and sort of faint, but the skirts much longer, and she's using them in different ways. And, you know, we would call this a skirt dance, but it's being sort of transformed into the shifting folds and lighting effects that she specializes in, beginning in the 1890s. So talking about innovation, how the stage is lighted, this appeared in Picture Magazine in 1896, and Louis was celebrated in art posters, magazines in the United States and in France throughout this decade. We see an artist sketching, trying to recreate some of the ways in which she made her performances special. And here you do see the underlighting, right? So there would be glass plates underneath, sometimes platforms, light could be from above, it could be from down below, and she's using very interesting gels and salts and using colors that dissolve into one another or create, you know, sort of mixtures. And she's, I can't stress how interested she was in science and in technology. At one point, she even had her own laboratory, and she collaborated with these technicians to think about the effects that she wanted to create. I don't want you to think that this was absolutely loose, that she just improvised when she got on stage. She took these electricians, as she called them, and technicians with her on the road. And I was asked earlier if she traveled. Yes, she went back and forth to America and performed there. She traveled throughout Europe and for different courts throughout Europe to, you know, quite privileged clientele, in addition to her time in France throughout these years. But this was very much a part of her performance, these effects that she could achieve. Her dress would be white, and it would register the various colors. And here we see but one of hundreds of posters. And I'm not exaggerating to say that she was represented by hundreds of artists hundreds of times. This is a poster by a Romanian artist, Pal, or so he was known, working in Paris at the time. And it's one that represents her Dance of Fire, as it was called. So she is celebrated for and associated with these particular dances, the Serpentine Dance, the Dance of Fire, the Lily Dance, which she performs throughout the years. And in this, I think we can see the idea that she is capturing this dynamism, the excitement of flame. She literally embodies it and is taking into account that fire isn't just red or orange. She's really thinking about how to create this exciting visual experience and a visceral experience of flame and light. And what is that? Well, in places it's going to be hotter and cooler. It's going to be white and blue and then orange and yellow. And so that is the effect that she creates. And obviously he's picking up on that, as well as the spirals, the torque that she's known for. And again, here she looks almost blonde. So we have quite artistic license with body type and hair and all that, but it's definitely her and her dance. Really, really quickly, she does patent some things, and these are just some examples of lighting effects, mirrors that she is able to patent. So science, technology, you can patent some of those things, some of the costumes that she created, costumes that not only included, you know, hundreds of yards of fabric, but at a certain point, bamboo poles, you know, 10 foot long. And when I say that, I don't want us just to think about the science behind that, but to remember that this is a body carrying these throughout a performance, the endurance not only of performing and dancing, but being able to manipulate on a regular basis these huge, heavy costumes and, you know, again, bamboo shoots and you know, heavy equipment, so to speak. So, you know, here we actually have patents that she applied for and got. Just to throw in, not exactly a side note, but a little bit more about her during this year, she is involved in two productions of Salome, very fin de siècle performance and production, right, after Oscar Wilde's sort of failure with it. And so, you know, anybody who is anybody tries to end up on the stage in Paris doing a little bit of Salome. She got mixed reviews. But I do want to suggest that, you know, she did try out different things and did still keep an interest in dramatic roles, especially if she could include forms of dance in them. So here's a wonderful dance of the hands from that. And here's, you know, again, the poster is very, very exciting. We, you know, these are artists responding. They're not just like trying to sell the show. They're responding to their excitement over this new performer, this amazing American performer who takes Paris by storm. There is the program for the second production of Salome that she does. And I'm hoping that you laugh a little bit, or at least, you know, not laugh at her, but sort of look at the pictures themselves, think about it in relation to the time period, and, you know, how we often look back and think that it looks a little sort of silly to us. But also, you can sort of see why perhaps she wasn't the best Salome, sort of physiognomically speaking. Trying her best here, but not quite set up to do that. Although, like her friend Sarah Bernhardt, would continue to be in productions, you know, past perhaps, you know, the age suggested by the character, shall we say. But this is Louis Fuller that people experienced, that they were captivated by, right? Underlighting, glass plates, etc. And, you know, it's not that these technologies didn't exist. They were fairly new, but a lot of them were being used for things like spectacles, fountains, like lit fountains outside. Louis saw those and said, well, if the fountains can be streamed with color, if we can do this kind of thing at world's fairs, why can't I do this? Why can't we implement that in the stage? So she's an innovator. She's an entrepreneur. Unfortunately, an entrepreneur who doesn't have a great business sense, like many people who are larger than life, so she's always sort of on the brink of, if not bankruptcy, but having to sort of scrounge around and find money, bless you, to pay for, you know, hotel bills and the things that she wants to accomplish. And there she is. And we can see those folds of drapery, you know, the enormous amount of fabric. And again, think physically what it takes. She may not have been trained as a dancer, but you have to have that power in your core to be able to do this night after night after night. And it's, you know, this kind of imagery on the stage at the Folies Bergères that it began to inspire all of the artists of Paris, some at the École des Beaux-Arts, some of the more settled, and in America as well. By the way, one of the innovations that she charted, if you will, or one of the things that she changed, and there are actually a couple at the Folies Bergères, is if you went to the Folies Bergères, you would be in that sort of horseshoe section of seats, but the lights wouldn't be off completely, right? Because you would walk to the bar, you would be talking with friends, etc. And she insisted for her performances, wherever they took place, that the lights had to be absolutely off so that she would emerge from darkness. And, you know, again, creating some very, very different effect, an abstraction, a visual experience that people were unused to, but which only heightened that sensation. Another thing that she did was to make matinees available for families and children. And this was unheard of at that time at the Folies Bergères. If you went, it was to go enjoy yourself and drink a bit at night, and even some women it might be considered a little louche or suspect to go to performances at the Folies Bergère, right? It was the high life. But she insisted that there be performances for children and their mothers, that they be allowed to come, that it become a dance and a performance. And children loved her. Although there was always a discrepancy. She talks a lot in her memoirs about children seeing her after performances and meeting them and them saying, "Mommy, mommy, who is this fat woman? Where is the fairy? Where is the butterfly?" And again, I'm not trying to make fun of her physiognomy. I'm just saying how absolutely transformative that she was able to recreate herself, you know, before Madonna, before Lady Gaga, and to come up with more than a shtick, to come up with a type of performance that was transfixing and inspiring to artists, to children, to everyone alike. So I just going to flash through, you know, some of the pictures and images and sculptures that were inspired by her. So this is William Bradley looking at her serpentine dance. And you can see it's just dissolved into these beautiful folds with these two little teeny feet. It's ephemeral. And I think comes close to, perhaps, his experience of her. And of course, there are, you know, cheesecakey, more sexy publicity posters that come out of that as well. And all of that speaks to some of the experience of Louis Fuller. I want to tie it in with Art Nouveau. And again, this talk was inspired by seeing little snippets of the Serpentine Dance. And it made me think I wanted to sort of research her, and I want to continue to do so. But what works we have at MoMA right now, which tie in really, really well, is if you go up to the third floor, if you haven't recently, or if you want to return to it, on the third floor, we have a section of Art Nouveau and international style. It's Art Nouveau if it's in France, design. It's international style if you look at the range from Gaudi to Macintosh to Viennese artists, etc., all throughout Europe during this time period from the 1890s through the second decade almost of the 20th century, we have this efflorescence, and that's a good word to use, the idea of flowering of this style in design, in architecture, in the visual arts. And here we have Hector Guimard's grille work. This is not upstairs, but we have furniture by him, or if you go into the sculpture garden, we have the entrance to the metro station in these organic, undulating forms. It is about the organic, the flowering, the twisted vines, these beautiful shapes, which appear again and again. So do go check out our third floor, especially after you're thinking about Louis Fuller's performances. Here are some Art Nouveau-style vases from around this time. And again, the intertwined, asymmetrical, beautiful look at nature. And of course, woman, the feminine, was what the Art Nouveau was all about. Right, this is not the heroic male style. And we see here Mucha's, one of his many posters of Sarah Bernhardt. I mentioned her earlier, of course, probably the most famous actress and personality of the time. Friends with Louise Fuller. They visited each other's performances quite a bit and spoke with each other, shared some artwork. And Mucha also represented Louis as well. But here, again, the notion of the decorative, the patterning, the taking from different historical periods we see embodied in this wonderful image of the actress here. You know, these wonderful flowers adorning her hair. And these are the forms that Louis takes into account. Now, some people say she even started the Art Nouveau. That's a heavy mantle to prove and to wear. But whether she did or not, she was part of the zeitgeist and helped further it and develop it and popularize it. Here's another publicity picture there, one that she actually gave to a good friend. And we can see, you know, from the numerous photographs, all the photographers of the day, some who are not really known to us, all of the people writing for the magazines, all of the people making posters representing her. So she was very much a part of popular culture on everyone's lips. Here she is performing the butterfly out of doors. And she performed indoors, out of doors, again, anywhere. And this is, you know, if you wanted to, you know, adorn yourself a la Louis, you would get this kind of necklace, which is not a portrait, of course, but it's, you know, sort of a reference to the kinds of dances that she's popularizing, which you would have seen represented in magazines, etc. Here's Toulouse-Lautrec. And again, she never commissioned anything by him. And interestingly, I you know, want to suggest, of course, the sense of movement and gesture that we get in this image here. He's made her out to be quite the redhead. He was always taken with redheads. But we go back to an image in MoMA's collection, not up right now, but it will be again soon, of Louise Weber, or La Goulue, at the Moulin Rouge. And there she is sort of in this very modern type of portrait, buoyed up by a sister or a friend and a lover behind her, the habitué of the Moulin Rouge, not paying attention to her, right? She's off stage. He doesn't care. It's this very modern, alienated scene. But mostly what I want to stress about this is that Toulouse-Lautrec was often known for giving a sense of that inner personality, letting it come out. And I think we get a sense of exhaustion, a sort of haughty quality. You know, a lot emanates from this very interesting portrait of his friend, La Goulue. But what Toulouse-Lautrec takes from Fuller is very different. He's thinking about, you know, her visual imagery, her becoming a type of abstraction. And this is a gorgeous image, a lithograph. And he used five different stones, or produced from five different stones, that is to say, and made about 60 of these. They're in different collections. Hopefully this will be out on display at some point. It's in our print collection at MoMA. And it's absolutely stunning. PowerPoint doesn't do justice, well, to any of these things, and certainly not to a dancer who should be shown in motion. But he created a color lithograph, which he was working in this media during this time, and goes over it with a little bit of watercolor and gold or silver powder on each of these. And so it shimmers, and I think it's very evocative of the experience, of the ephemerality, the abstraction, again, the sort of visual signage that Louis embodied and gave forth. One of my favorite images is not in MoMA's collection, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't look at it. And this is Koloman Moser, an Austrian artist known a lot more for his design and interior decoration. We do have some of his pieces in our collection. Excuse me. This is a gorgeous image, and it's a painting. And you know that idea of the performer coming out of the darkness, emerging from the primordial, whatever experience you would get, lit mystically, magically by gorgeous lights. I think we get that sense. He had been traveling in Paris, and like many people, was inspired by her and creates this image. I mean, that's her right there. And I'm sure it evokes many different things for all of us, but it is undulating, it is organic. I always think of a sea creature underwater. But you may have your own sort of take on that. And for him to have experienced this and then to give it to us in this way, I think is quite amazing and a testament to the impact that she had on culture and all of the arts. Really, really quickly, some of the other people who were touched by her, not Edouard Manet, he didn't live to see her. He died in 1883, but this is Edouard Manet's image of Stéphane Mallarmé from 1876 and a part of a Mallarmé poem. And that's not a typo or a problem with the PowerPoint. That's Mallarmé radicalizing poetry and spreading the words, you know, across the page. Now we're all acclimated to all of these things, to dance and performance and lighting and, you know, poetry that does all kinds of things, but Mallarmé, of course, was absolutely innovative. So here's his portrait, and I love how Manet actually sort of, even though he's representing the wallpaper sort of casually, you know, sprinkles the decorative qualities there. And there's a really ephemeral quality to the smoke that Mallarmé sort of nonchalantly holds there. But this idea of different fonts or different sizes and, you know, words being sprinkled all over. Sprinkled sounds not deliberate enough, but the idea of overthrowing tradition and classicism, and certainly he saw that in Louis Fuller. He invited her to numerous salons. She was very much a part of his circle, and he said things like, you know, she embodied the physicality of an idea. So for him and many others, I think she is an idea, she's an abstraction, she's an orchid, she's an butterfly. And there she is as a flower. And by the way, I'm just going to make an aside looking at this. Don't try this at home. Or do. But, you know, she's not caught up. But most of us would be. And I'm looking at Jody there who, Jody, I'm going to just point you out. Jody has, does Louise dances and adds to them. And so I didn't know if she was coming today, but I'm thrilled to have her here. And she could certainly tell you, and maybe she will, it's not easy. It's not easy. So imagine this, and imagine if you don't have the experience, Louie could get herself out of that. She meant to do that. One other person I just want to mention is Claude Debussy, who was a real proponent of the arts. He celebrated Camille Claudel in the 1890s. He purchased art, and he too was swept up by Louis Fuller. And here is a part of his prelude for piano, Les Voiles, which he wrote inspired by Louis Fuller. So there's an interchange between the arts and a dramatic connection that she's going around inspiring people. And in fact, Debussy, I believe, said something to the effect of, "She was the only one who danced my music." I mean, you know, when he saw her dance, that was the spirit, what he felt. I mean, that's pretty intense. She is not just, you know, a fly-by-night performer. She is the spirit of the age. Really, really quickly, as I'm speeding up here, a poster for the Universal Exposition of 1900. There we get a little scenery and experience of that, often called the Art Nouveau Exposition. Here's a poster that was made by Orazi. We have this in our collection, and it was meant to celebrate Louis Fuller. And, you know, again, not much that looks like her as she floats with these beautiful medallions, a reference to Japanese art, which, you know, was très fascinable, very, very fashionable, très chic at this moment, and something that Louis drew upon. She was very interested in Japanese culture and Japanese dance and theater, as well as, you know, Hindu dance and you know, other exotic themes, but she was interested in the patterns and the fabrics, etc. And so that comes across, and so does the shifting beautiful light that we get there, a reference, of course, to her performances. She was successful enough to commission her own pavilion. It was supposed to cost like 10,000 francs. It cost 50,000. Like I said, she was always on the verge of bankruptcy. But that's how successful. And in some ways, it was her exposition. Not only did she create her own pavilion, the dance pavilion, separate, the French dance pavilion, remember, she's an American, had sculptures dedicated to her on it. And this is just a bad drawing, forgive me, of Henri Sauvage's, he was a young up-and-coming 27-year-old architect who worked for her. Not happily. She was not easy to work with. He called her, and others have called her, a pushing woman, right? She says, what's up with the French, you know? They say it's going to take 6 months. It got done in 6 weeks. That's because she was a pushing woman. She knew what she wanted all along with her dance, with her presentation. And, you know, of course, we see this sort of homage to her there. We see the undulating forms of the outside of this temporary structure echoing that of the Art Nouveau. And inside, of course, she's promoting herself by having images of all the different artists who represented her. So, statuettes. She would often give these to friends, by the way. This is Raoul François Larcher. But there were numerous. There were hundreds of these that were produced. And you could get, you know, ones with lampshades, and you could get statuettes. And so she would always sort of leave them with friends. But the whole pavilion was covered with celebrations of her. Quickly, I just want to mention her promotion of other artists, including Sarajaco. And this is an interesting image because it's done by Pablo Picasso, who's traveling back and forth from Spain to France. He'll settle there permanently in 1904, that is France. But right now, he's showing some works at the exposition, and he's looking at everything. And one of the things he comes across is this wonderful actress, whom Louis had discovered, if you will, and began to promote. And actually, at her pavilion, she had Sada perform. And then the second half of the performance, you know, after the intermission, would be Louis dancing. So she really was trying to promote this actress in sort of pantomime kind of experience theater and get her out there, get her seen. And Rodin, who becomes friends with Louis, writes about this experience and talks about the Japanese dancers in the larger exposition, but also Sada. And she sits for Rodin, and, you know, more importantly than visual representation, is the fact that Loic, because she promoted Sada, and because Sada Yacco was such a success, and went on tour after this in Europe, and actually Loic was supposed to go back to Japan, didn't happen, the Japanese government changed its policy. So the men were actors, and they played all the women's parts. But in fact, they changed this, and Japan opened it up so that people like Sada could actually perform back at home. I'm gonna keep rolling here. I mentioned Rodin. He was great friends with Loic, and she promoted his art in America. A lot of the work that we have, especially in California, of Rodin's, she contributed to that promotion. She used to hang out with him and his common-law wife, Rose Buret, a lot, and her dancers, when she opened a dance school, would frequent the grounds. Here's an image by Rodin of Loic Fuller. And there she is, and I sort of moved to the last years of her life. Here she is dancing on somebody's grounds. I'm not quite sure whether that is Rodin's or someplace else. But of course, you know, age caught up with her a bit. She, you know, had problems with her back. She had sort of constant bronchitis. And so as early as 1908, she continued performing, but she also opened up a dance school with young girls who were about 8 to 20 and toured with them throughout Europe and, you know, the United States and elsewhere. And I love this photograph with Loic there with her young pupils in front of the Sphinx. And I just want to sort of, you know, suggest that she's not only, you know, during the teens and into the 20s, you know, continuing to perform when she can, but she's promoting others. Even in, early in the 19th century, she had befriended Isadora Duncan and helped promote her career. They sort of broke, but always admired each other's work after that. And so she innovated the dance world in many different ways. And someone was asking me before, and, you know, I think different people have different answers, but she broke new ground. You know, what is the legacy of this? How is this in relation to Martha Graham and other things? I mean, Loic changed the culture of Paris during this time and befriended these other artists, including Isadora Duncan, who continued to expand notions of visual arts, of music, and of dance. And one has to imagine she's competing in the 1920s and her dancers are, the Féerie Fantastique, are competing with the likes of Josephine Baker. And I end by showing you her last, the thing she had her hand last in, and then I have to wrap up. She became involved in film. Even early on, she had known filmmakers, but she turned a story that a friend of hers, the Queen Marie of Romania, had written. She turned it into a film, and it was known when the cinematographer wouldn't do certain things that she wanted. She just sort of took over and created the film that she wanted to create. And I think that sort of, you know, even in her last years, she held true to her own convictions, her own vision, and, you know, brought her personality through. So this is just a film still from that. But of course, I want us to end just with one last gasp of looking at and being captivated by, you know, the gorgeous iteration, incarnation, embodiment, and abstraction that Loic Fuller gave through her performance. So, thank you. Now, I've gone a little bit over, but I'm happy to take questions for those who feel like staying, and thank you. Yeah?
What was the fabric she used, or did she use different fabrics?
My understanding is that it's silk, and Jody, you might discuss, you're the expert. And, you know, that's not always what people are able to do when they try things out, depending on how much money they have to sort of experience or try out some of Loic's dances. Yeah. Loic.
Did she work with particular fashion designers, and did any of her outfits work their way into fashion trends during that period?
I have two answers to that. And again, I've read several books about her, but I haven't come across much about the fashion design. What I do know is that she inspired fashion, not just in necklaces, but that they, at the Folies Bergère, there were a number of dresses and costumes that were inspired by her, and I'm sure that it trickled down into some of popular culture. I'm not sure that she worked with somebody like, say, Paul Poche or anybody like that. Jody's shaking her head. So.
She was very secretive about her costumes, and she would never have one dressmaker do them. She would do part of one shop, costume shop, and then have somebody else do another part because everybody was wanted to. In fact, a news reporter once asked her to know the width of the hem of her skirt. She said she wouldn't say that for 1 month's salary. So she would constantly.
Yeah. And you can imagine why. Yeah.
So she was very secretive, and she didn't patent the customs designs because patents are public.
Yeah. Very good. Oh, yes. Well.
Do you know if there was any dialogue between her and the futurists with all this sort of talk of dynamism and motion?
I don't. I mean, I'm sort of, you know, reaching through, and again, I'm going to call on Jody if.
Patrizio Paroli, who's an Italian scholar, has written a lot about what we were and the futures. So I would recommend she just published a book in Italian. But I know that she would, that there is a connection and an influence. And I think if you see the futures were interested at the same time, at different places, and if you look, the thing about Louis Ferrer's art is. And it was so influential in so many different modernist movements, as Larissa pointed out. We have Art Nouveau, we have symbolism, futurism, right. But also not just in, you know, in the visual arts, but in drama and music and in film. So
absolutely.
All of those, she was like everything to everybody.
Yeah.
You know.
And again, over different time periods as well.
And she spanned, she had a long career. So there is a connection.
Learn Italian.
What was the weight of this fabric?
I'm sorry, what was the
what
weight
was
of
the
fabric?
Weight?
That I'm going to throw to Jody again.
She always used the lightest weight fabric possible.
But how much was she carrying at the time?
So the weight, it weighs almost nothing.
Huh?
So in the Lily Dance, in a costume like this, she claimed to use 500 yards of silk. And actually,
makes a lot of claims, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, the claims are always trumped up in the media reports, but the silk itself weighs very little, but when you extend it into space, there's a lot of torque, and the longer that you make the ones, the exponentially more force is required. Mm-hmm. So it becomes extremely, the smaller the costume, it's manageable, and then the larger it gets, it becomes, as I say, exponentially more
difficult. Yeah.
What?
She could fly away.
Yeah. Doing it outside is, I'll tell you, you need even a whisper of a breeze creates these serious problems.
Wow. It's very, very interesting. And again, you know, it's great to hear from you just because you've performed. What is your favorite dance, Javi?
Well, what I do is I'm not interested in recreating specific
mm-hmm.
of her, or have taken the genre
right.
and created something contemporary with it. But I mean, she definitely was most known for her most famous dance was her fire dance, and in a way harnessed the most innovative elements of technology, in particular under lighting. And the other element which she used was projections. So she was creating a multimedia experience before there was such a thing as multimedia.
And I think it's so interesting too, just the ties in with early cinema, and of course the futurists. And I want to say that it was a great sort of, and I wish I knew more about it. But obviously, the idea of time, duration, movement, and they look to early cinema, and you know, of course, and then it goes back and forth. So the sort of interchange of the different disciplines all throughout the 2 decades is quite amazing. But the idea of projection and all that as well. So, anybody else? Yes.
Did she ever dance either with a partner or with an ensemble, or was she always doing solo dances?
She danced with her students at times. She didn't dance with a man. No, not like the not like Lagunita had the snake man
not
or
like
something. No, that was not her thing. She was a woman apart. That was her thing. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Does that young woman perform this?
She does, and again, I just read about it.